In the name of the one God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Well, thank you very much indeed for your welcome. I'm not quite sure what I'm doing at the moment. I mean, is this a sermon or is it a lecture? I hope that you will bear with me in my confusion about that. I know that you've had a distinguished panel of speakers already. And again, I feel as the odd man out. I'm certainly not distinguished in any way, and maybe not just the odd man out, but perhaps the awkward one. We shall see. I want to begin by saying that the spiritual dimension in human beings is innate to them. All the research that we know about is showing us that, whether it is with children, and a lot has been done by David Hay and his collaborators in this respect, or indeed that old organization in Oxford, the Alistair Hardy Institute, or whether it is with people who do not belong to any kind of organized religion. Again, research has shown that their spiritual awareness is very much present, even if they are unable to articulate it. It is innate. It is not, therefore, a virus with which we might be infected, nor is it some mythical entity that jumps from brain to brain. And I say this because each one of us, and many people outside, use this spiritual awareness to make sense of their lives, of their destinies, to give meaning to who they are and what they do. This is important to note because much of what I will say this evening has to do not so much with this personal awareness of the spiritual, but more with the social dimension of it. And that, of course, is properly called religion. Religion is about what binds people together in terms of the spiritual dimension of life. In fact, throughout the course of history, we find that religion undergirds the customs, the values, the laws of nearly every community, human community that we know of every civilization. Sometimes I feel that the emphasis and the popularity of spirituality these days overemphasizes the individual. Because, of course, when we think of the spiritual in its social context, then that has implications for how we live, for our behavior, how we relate to other people, and so on. And, of course, these days people don't want that kind of thing. Thank you very much. The British School of Sociologists began to say some years ago that in some societies, particularly this one, of course, that the social function of religion was being replaced by things like democracy and the welfare state. So democracy provides the legitimation for what we do, as religion once did, according to them, and the welfare state supplies the needs that the churches once used to meet. Well, I think the thesis is somewhat overblown, if I may say so. We know that the welfare state has many holes in it now, and indeed the holes will get bigger as the years go on, and the government is already turning to churches and other faith communities to fill those holes. Nor does democracy provide the legitimation for everything that we do. Counting heads does not make things right. This is a lesson we need to learn. Sometimes principles have to be invoked that are beyond even the collective wisdom of a nation. At the earlier stages of life, when is there a human person? How should we treat those earlier stages? At the later stages, what is so valuable about human beings that other human beings cannot take from them? All of these issues and many more cannot simply be decided by counting heads. So democracy is not enough as legitimation. I will come back to that in a moment. So we still need that cohesive function that religion fulfills and has fulfilled in so many societies in the past and also across the world today. But this cohesive function is not religion's only function. It has another, which we might call the prophetic. Particularly the Semitic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, have this prophetic side very much to the fore. And it enables, for instance, the individual to stand over and against his or her society in particular circumstances. It helps the poor to stand up to the rich, and the oppressed to those who are their oppressors. As I say, the Abrahamic faiths are particularly characterized by this prophetic aspect of religion, but other faiths also show them. It is arguably the case that Buddhism as a social reality is to be understood as a criticism of the caste system of Hinduism. And similarly, the Sikhism began as an anti-caste movement. Indeed, within Hinduism itself, there have been such movements that have challenged inequality and injustice. By now you will be saying, this is an apologetic for religion. Isn't there a darker side to religion? Does not religion cause conflict and war and suffering? And I think we should agree immediately that there is a darker side to religion, that religion can and does go wrong. I have had personal experience of this when I went on behalf of Christian Aid during the civil war in Bosnia. The idea was that Christian Aid and Islamic Relief would arrive at some agreement to deliver aid to people in terms of need and regardless of confession. Well, because the communities were so badly divided, even in towns and villages, this proved to be a very limited possibility. Nevertheless, what I did learn in the course of my time there was how religion can be pressed into chauvinistic nationalism in a way that I found very distressing. But of course, Bosnia or the Balkans or the former Yugoslavia are not the only examples of this. There are many other examples that can be given. Who would have thought, for example, that in post-Gandhian India, we could have had the killings of Christians in Orissa that happened a few years ago? And radical Islamism, with which I am very familiar, I'm sorry to have to say, has caused immeasurable suffering in the world, particularly to Christians and other communities living throughout the Middle East and in many other parts of the world. So religion can and does go wrong. There is a darker side to it, but in this, religion is not unique. Nearly everything that is valuable in human existence can go wrong. Patriotism can go wrong. Patriotism is a great thing, to love your country. We are in the Queen's Diamond Jubilee, and I hope we shall see some fine instances of genuine patriotism. But it can go wrong, can't it? It can become narrow and inward and excluding. And we have to be always on our guard for patriotism becoming chauvinism. Human love can go wrong. What a great thing human love is between parent and child, between husband and wife. But we also know when it goes wrong, it causes terrific havoc. Religion is not then on its own in going wrong. It is also true that whilst religion has been an element in some conflict in this world, I've given the example of Bosnia already, but we could take Northern Ireland nearer home, or we could take the tragic partition of the Indian subcontinent. Certainly religion was an element in all of those conflicts. But the major conflicts of the 20th century, for example, were not caused by religion. They were caused by secular totalitarian ideology. Whether it is National Socialism in Germany, or Stalinism, which arguably caused more suffering and death than even the Nazis had done, or Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution, which tried to destroy a people's ancient civilization, or Pol Pot, or even Saddam Hussein. You know, the Ba'ath Party was not a religious party. It was intentionally modeled on the European fascist parties of the 1920s and 30s. So if religion can cause conflict and suffering, then so can other things. Having said that, I believe that we live in a time when it is important for religions to be accountable in two ways. First of all, at the bar of world opinion. And secondly, to one another. No religion, no believers can now say this is purely an internal matter, let us sort this out. Whether it is the treatment of women, or of children, or of of people who do not belong to that particular faith, who belong to another faith or to no faith at all. We are accountable to world opinion, to what the world thinks of us, and also to one another. And I believe this is one of the major reasons for dialogue between the faiths. I am not particularly keen on what has been called kissy-kissy dialogue, where we pat one another on our backs and say how, you know, what good people we are. Well, that may be so, but that's not enough. And so dialogue has to be about the hard things in life. It has to be about fundamental freedom for people, wherever they may be. It has to do with asking hard questions about what religions teach about human dignity and equality and liberty. Now, in this connection, Islam and Christianity are in a special position. And the reason is that these are, in our day, the two great missionary faiths. They're both spreading rapidly in many parts of the world. And Christians and Muslims find themselves cheek by jowl with one another in old and new situations. I was in the town of Kaduna in northern Nigeria a few years ago, and the person showing me around without any self-consciousness was saying, well, this is the Christian area, Bishop, and if you go beyond the bridge, that's the Muslim area, and when we have trouble, we seal off the bridge. In fact, what he was describing was the cantonization of so many towns in that country, particularly in the central and northern part. Dialogue has to be about the difficult questions in life. But Christians and Muslims, and indeed Jews for that matter, have had a long history together. There has never been a time since the rise of Islam as a historical religion that Christians, Muslims and Jews have not been living together. It is not an untroubled story. I don't want to pretend in any way about that. But it is a long one, and we can learn from it. From the very beginning, there has been the possibility of friendship. When the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, wanted to send his followers into exile because of persecution by the pagans, he chose to send them to the Christian empire, as it then was, of Abyssinia or Ethiopia, as we now call it. And the Muslims were given refuge there, and indeed many of them survived for that reason. When the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, went to Medina, he very soon promulgated something called the Sahifat al-Madina, the Constitution of Medina, which gave equal rights to all the residents of Medina, whether Jewish or Christian or Muslim or indeed pagan. A number of people these days want an Islamic state here or there. And when they do, I say to them, will it be like the first one? And if not, why not? But of course, the point is that the arrangements made even at that time did not last. That's the tragedy. And so we have a long litany which is both negative and positive as far as the relationships are concerned. As Islam spread throughout the world, and its spread was very rapid indeed, it eclipsed very quickly what was then the center of the Christian world. You know, the main Christian cities were in the Middle East: Alexandria, Damascus, Jerusalem, and as it spread also towards Persia, and the Persian Empire was conquered very quickly because it had become exhausted with its perpetual feuding with the other great empire in the area, Byzantium. As it spread, there was, first of all, a destruction of communities: Christian, Jewish, Zoroastrian. This had happened already during the Prophet of Islam's lifetime, when certain Jewish tribes were liquidated, let us say. And it continued to happen even under the great general responsible for the Islamic expansion, Khalid bin Walid. So much so that the second caliph, Umar, had to discipline him. Secondly, people were dispersed. Again, this had happened during the Prophet of Islam's lifetime, but it continued to happen. The Prophet had said, apparently, on his deathbed, that the Arabian Peninsula should have only one religion. This has recently been repeated by the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia. But the result of that was that those Christian and Jewish communities with which the Prophet had made solemn treaties in his lifetime were expelled. So the Jews of Arabia went to Jericho, and the Christians went to Iraq. There is nothing new under the sun. Not only destruction and dispersion, but there was also discrimination. The system that we now know as the Dhimma was set in place, which allowed certain communities like Christians, Jews, later on Zoroastrians, to continue to live under Islamic rule, but under severe disabilities. So they could keep their churches, but they could not repair them without permission, and they could not build new ones. So much of the trouble that we've had in Egypt recently has been precisely about this question. Can the very large Coptic community build new churches? Attempts by the government to ease the situation have firmly been resisted in many parts of the community. They had to pay a special tax. They could not carry arms. They had to wear special dress. They could not ride horses, but only donkeys, and so on. I mean, these were the disabilities of the Dhimma with which the Christians of the Middle East and other parts of the world lived for centuries. But even with these negative and mixed developments, as we might call them, there were also positive elements in the relationship. So between the 8th and the 10th centuries, we can count 9 Christian apologists of the first rank who engaged with Islam and attempted in its own terms to give an account of their Christian faith. This tradition of dialogue, which of course continued in one way or another, is worth studying because the way in which Christians who lived in the Muslim world evaluated Islam was quite different from the way in which Byzantium on the one hand and Western Europe on the other, looking at it from the outside, was evaluating it. St. John of Damascus, the greatest theologian perhaps of the Eastern Church, wrote a dialogue with Muslims in which he takes as his point of departure the common belief that Christians, Muslims, and Jews have in the oneness of God. He uses the Quran to talk about Jesus Christ, and whilst he is quite clear about his testimony and his witness to his Christian faith, nevertheless we can see that here is a man whose family had, after all, opened the gates of Damascus for the Muslim armies, and a man who had himself held high office under the Umayyad caliphs. Not only was there dialogue, but Jews and Christians particularly contributed to the development of what came to be called Islamic civilization. You know, people often say, how did these people who had come from the desert suddenly develop this great intellectual and material civilization? Well, part of the answer is that they wanted to do so. But the other is that Jews and Christians played a very prominent role in this, in nearly every aspect of life. But let me just give you one. This is often mentioned in Western universities, and I know Warwick is a great university town, so it may be of some interest, therefore. It is often said, rightly, that the West received the learning of the Greeks in its different aspects from the Muslim Arabs, received it back. It was then used in the older Western universities like Paris and Oxford, this is true. But the prior question is never asked, which is, how did the Muslims get it? And almost without exception, the Muslims got it through Christian clergy. The clergy do have their uses. Christian clergy from the different churches studied and translated the main corpus of Greek learning, either directly from Arabic from Greek into Arabic, or from Greek into Syriac into Arabic. Very distinguished father and son team, Hunan ibn Ishaq and Ishaq ibn Hunan. The father knew better Greek, so he translated from Greek into Syriac. The son knew better Arabic, so he translated from Syriac into Arabic. Between them, they translated the whole of the Greek medical corpus into Arabic. It was this that was received by the West and was the basis for the medical syllabus, for example, in Oxford, right up until the 18th century. Now, this feast of reason and flow of soul was interrupted in two ways. It was interrupted, first of all, by the Crusades. I don't want to go into the detail of that, but it is an important element in Muslim-Christian relationships and therefore ought to be mentioned. The Crusades were called for three reasons. One was that the newly converted to Islam Seljuk Turks were preventing Western pilgrims from reaching the Holy Land. And you will remember that at that time, reaching the Holy Land was very important for Christians because it was the fifth gospel. It was the way in which people understood the other four gospels. That is still the case, of course. Secondly, a mad Fatimi caliph had destroyed the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. He also destroyed many Muslim places of worship and learning. But this caused incredible alarm throughout the Christian world, the destruction of the Holy Sepulchre. Thirdly, the Eastern Emperor in Byzantium explicitly asked the Pope for help because of the pressure of the Muslim armies on Constantinople. Now, of course, not everything in the Crusades is justified or justifiable. There was great barbarity and greed, but there was also chivalry on both sides. I don't want to go into all of that, but it does mark a watershed in Muslim-Christian relations. The second big disruption, if you like, was the arrival of the Mongols. The Mongols were part of Central Asian peoples who had been coming into the Middle East and Southern and Eastern Europe for centuries. The Turks are also part of that. But the Mongols caused incredible destruction. It is impossible for us to imagine the destruction that they caused. So when the Mongols conquered Baghdad in 1258, the Persian poet Sa'di, looking at the destruction of Baghdad, says, "Muhammad, if you are to come on Judgment Day, come now, because this is Judgment Day." And a well-known Arab historian, in narrating the destruction of Baghdad, writes that he wishes that he had never been born to have to write such things. But the Mongols had among them some tribes that were Shia, and so the Shia in Baghdad were not as badly treated. And some of the Mongol princes were married to Nestorian Christian women. And so the Christians were not so badly treated. But the Sunnis were. I have just been to Baghdad and looked at this almost unending conflict, it seems, between Shia and Sunni and between Muslim and Christian. And you think, well, this goes back a very long way. Always to learn from history. Now, the result of all of this was that Arab supremacy in the Muslim world was once and for all replaced by something else. And that something else was a very small and at first insignificant Turkish tribe that gradually became the Ottoman Empire, the largest Muslim empire that the world has ever seen. And the experience of empire for so many people has not really been that of Western imperialism, but of Ottoman imperialism in the Balkans, for example, and in many parts of the Middle East. The Ottomans, it is worth mentioning one element of what they did because I believe it is still relevant for us today. They borrowed an idea from the pre-Islamic Persians called the Millet system, which was to recognize the autonomy of the different ethnic and religious communities throughout this vast empire to make the empire workable. This means that wherever the Ottomans have ruled, particular ethnic and religious communities have a very high view of their independence. And this is why, whether it's the Balkans or Iraq, unitary forms of government are very difficult to institute and to operate. Some kind of federal or confederal solution has to be found because of the legacy of the millet system. The Ottomans were prevailed upon ultimately by Western powers, Britain and France in the main, to abolish the dhimma. You remember the dhimma, where non-Muslims are all treated as subjects but not citizens. This meant that for the first time, about 150 years ago, Jews and Christians found themselves throughout the Ottoman Empire as equal citizens with Muslims. Now, Zionism had already begun, and although it began with European Jewry, Oriental Jewry also became more and more interested in it, and so they did not play a part in the emerging nationalisms of the Middle East as the Ottoman Empire began to break up and was replaced finally by the Republic of Turkey. But the Christians did, you see. The Christians played a very prominent part, out of all proportion to their actual numbers, in the emergence of the Nahda of Arab nationalism. So many of the great thinkers who articulated this philosophy of Arab nationalism based on language and culture and history and not so much on religion were in fact Christians of one denomination or another. The problem, of course, is that this nationalism, whether in the Arab world or elsewhere, began from about the 1950s to be seen as alien, an implant from somewhere else. And sometimes it was. It took place under European inspiration in many cases. The rise of Islamism as an organized system of thought dates from this criticism of secular nationalism. Let's call it that for the time being. Now, Islamism is not just about grievances. You know, sometimes the press makes it out that it is. It is a fundamental worldview, an ideology, if you like, which is based in its Sunni manifestation on the restoration of the caliphate, for example, on the ultimate abolition of the nation state, to be replaced by pan-Islam, by the recovery of lands lost to Islam. What are they, the lands lost to Islam? Well, of course, Israel is one of them, but India might be another, the Iberian Peninsula another. I mean, you know, many examples can be given. And then, of course, the implementation of Sharia. However, grievances do feed the ideology, do obtain recruits for the ideology. The experience of Western colonialism and imperialism certainly did that in the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. Neo-colonialism, even more so, the experience of Suez. I mean, when you think, Sayyid Qutb began to write immediately after that crisis. In the Shia world, the destabilization by Western powers of the moderately socialist government of Prime Minister Musaddiq and the forced return of the Shah was the seed that was sown, and the harvest was the Islamic Revolution of 1979. the corruption of Muslim elites themselves. Many of the Islamist writers are quite as hostile to their own rulers and their own elites as they are to the West. The Islamic Revolution in Iran began in South Tehran, where the slums were. You can still see some signs of them, though greatly improved South Tehran is now, it has to be said. And the people marched to North Tehran, where the Shah was trying to build a kind of Switzerland, and where the slum dwellers were not allowed. Well, if you create inequality like that, what do you get? The failure of both command economy, socialism, and of capitalism in the Islamic world has won large numbers of recruits for radical Islamism. So command economy, socialism failed for the usual reasons, inefficiency, shoddy goods in the shops, hidden unemployment in Egypt and Syria and many places like that. And capitalism also failed. I remember when I was working with some very poor people in Pakistan, talking to an official of the World Bank who said to me, quite clearly, he said, "We only know the rich, and we only therefore work with the rich. We hope that the effects of our work with the rich trickle down to the poor." And I said at that time I was working with brick kiln laborers, bonded labor, I said, "I didn't see any sign of this trickling down with these people I was working with." And certainly the World Bank has listened to people and has changed some of its policies, but capitalism in a country like Pakistan simply made the rich richer and the poor poorer. There can be no doubt about that, and that is one of the reasons why so many people have been recruited to extremist causes. Now, to come finally to some of the issues with which we are faced in the light of the story. The first question is, what is the relationship of religion to the state? We owe it, I think, to Islamism that this is a question now that has to be asked. The question is not whether religion should have anything to do with the state, but what should be the relationship. And I think we would want to say, would we not, that the relationship must be one of persuasion rather than of coercion. That theocracy needs to be renounced on all sides in the context of dialogue. Then what is the relationship to democracy? It is not enough to come to power by democratic means. It is also necessary to be willing to renounce power through democratic means. You see, that is the test of democracy. And the jury must be out on whether certain radical groups that acquire power democratically will be able to renounce it also so easily. Thirdly, democracy is not enough. You know, in the course of the Arab Spring, we have been told again and again that this is for democracy. Well, hallelujah, that's great. But democracy on its own, wherever it may be, it's also true here, on its own, democracy can become simply a tyranny of the majority. No less tyranny. And so, in addition to democracy, for example, in a country like Egypt today, we also need other guarantees, a Bill of Rights, for instance, that guarantees the equality of all before the law, a common citizenship, no return to dhimma, for instance. The equality of all before the law, one law for all of these things are necessary alongside democracy. What about religion and law? On the one hand, it is true that law without moral force is just tyranny. It is true also that many people of no faith are very moral beings. But at the same time, the great moral codes by which people have lived have all arisen, without exception, in a religious context. Whether it is the laws of Manu in Hinduism, or the Torah of Israel, or the Sharia of Islam, the canon law of the church, they have all arisen in religious contexts and have aided in the development of public law in this society or that. However, in the West certainly, public law has acquired an autonomy from any particular religious community. And this is right. This is how it should be. The law should recognize freedom of belief, freedom to manifest our beliefs, and freedom of conscience. But it would be hugely problematic if a religious system of law like the Sharia were to be recognized, for example, in terms of public law in this country. The reason is that public law in this country has arisen out of a Judeo-Christian context, and the principles of Sharia contradict those principles. So you would be introducing a contradictory element into public law if Sharia were to be recognized in terms of public law, not simply in terms of the observance of Muslims, which of course we should struggle for them to be free to have. Justifiability of conflict. I mentioned this earlier. It is urgent in our world where there will not be, I think, so many conventional wars between states, but there will have to be armed action, for example, to prevent genocide, or to protect vital interests, for example, the flow of oil, or to protect particular communities. It is very important that the international community should be helped by the different faiths to arrive at some idea of when conflict is justifiable. Now, Christians have the just war tradition, which has been used. If the idea of jihad can be freed from its radical extremist interpretations, there are elements in that doctrine also that could be used by the international community to argue for the justifiability of conflict in particular circumstances, as in Bosnia, as in Kosovo. I am always bemused, I think is the right word, that when international intervention has taken place to protect Muslims, that's been okay. But when it has taken place to protect others from radical Islamists, or even other Muslims from radical Islamists, then that is not acceptable. So we need some good, hard conversation about these things. And then finally, the whole question of reciprocity. This is raised again and again, and understandably, Christians in the West say, well, if there can be mosques in Washington or London or Rome, why can't there be churches in Riyadh or Jeddah or, you know, many places I could name? And indeed, this is something that is understandable, but I take reciprocity to be more than just tit for tat. When we talk about reciprocity, we must mean, must we not, that in the context of dialogue, Muslims and Christians should come to a common commitment about fundamental human freedoms, a common commitment. Wherever they are, wherever they have influence, if Christians have influence to make sure that Muslims are free to worship and to express their faith, and where Muslims have influence to make sure that Christians have similar freedoms. I have been in dialogue for many years with Al-Azhar al-Sharif, the premier place of Sunni learning in Egypt, And before the disturbances in Egypt, we were reaching a stage where we could say that there was some element of reciprocity in our relationships in this respect. This must be greatly encouraged throughout the world, because world peace depends upon it. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your patience in listening to these ramblings. I look forward to what you have to say by way of response.